It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning.
He's on vacation.
Do we know where?
he could be on the moon for all I know.
Yeah, okay.
No, I think he's going to be down in, did he say he was going to be down in Arizona?
I can't remember if that was this trip or that
or
was
the last trip.
I think
yeah.
that was the last trip.
And maybe
he's going
trip.
Back. Who knows? All right. Well, since we don't even have anything clever to make up.
The job is missing.
Yes. If you find him, please return him. The woman at the white courtesy telephone. All right. Let's start with local and developments this week with the deep bore tunnel.
Yes. The replacement for the Alaskan Way Viaduct. The city council and the mayor have been going back and forth on this for a while. This week, the city council decided to put off a vote on three agreements that are necessary, that have to be passed in order for construction on the tunnel to go continue. Those three agreements are between the Washington State Department of Transportation and the Seattle Department of Transportation, Seattle City Light, and the Seattle Public Utilities. And they're over right-of-ways, permitting, and, you know, the relocation of utilities. So they're pretty necessary to votes that and three pretty necessary agreements that have to be voted on by the city council. But after supporters of the tunnel on city council have been saying, you know, don't to Mayor McGinn, you know, stop criticizing the tunnel because this is just going to contribute to delays on construction. And the more you delay, the more expensive it's going to be. And the more, the more you delay, the more likely you'll have cost overruns. And that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know. Well, after saying all that, for the city council supporters of the tunnel to sit down and say, oh, well, let's put off this vote until the beginning of next year, that's pretty crazy. They decided instead that next week they're going to vote on, what do they call it? They call it a resolution, which is really a statement of intent to eventually vote for the agreements early next year. It's not not as binding as an actual vote on the agreements would be. It's really just a statement of intent. Yeah, we like the way they look. We'll eventually approve them. And supposedly that will allow contractors to go forward and bid on the tunnel project. But you have to ask, okay, after weeks of saying, you know, we need to move the process along, why are they stalling now? Well, the answer to that is pretty simple. It's because public opinion polls are turning against the tunnel. And not just against the tunnel project itself, but they're also turning against the politicians that support the tunnel. So it's pretty clear to me it's a political move that city council members are saying, well, we don't want to vote on any agreement that will put the city of Seattle on the line for tunnel for our share of the costs, including the overruns on the tunnel construction, until after the election happens in November.
And yet none of them are up for election this
nope,
year.
Nope.
So
they're
it isn't
just,
like they're...
Yeah, they're just worried. They're not worried only about themselves. They're also worried about people who support the tunnel at the Port of Seattle, at in the state legislature and so on. So they're looking at, well, you know, things are not going our way right now, so let's just put it off. It's pretty silly.
It seems like there's always an election that elected officials are scared of.
Yeah, even when they're not up for election. Anyway, so your recommended reading this week is to go to the Crosscut website and read Jean Godden's article. She wrote an opinion piece where she slammed Mayor McGinn, calling him a fearmonger, saying, you know, he's just raising these unreasonable fears about cost overruns. And then read the rebuttal by Skip Berger, who wrote a very good rebuttal of Godden's argument, saying, you know, Mayor McGinn is not a fearmonger. He's raising very valid concerns. And when you've got a project that's going to be over $1 billion, cost overruns are a very valid concern. And most projects of that size do end up having cost overruns. So, and it's really, he's doing his job by saying, you know, we need to address this, and we need to address who is responsible for this, because if we don't have an agreement with the state, it's going to eventually go to court, and that's going to cost the city and the state a lot of money. And, you know, I found that to be an extremely reasonable argument. I mean, that's how I feel about it. So if you want to see the city council's position, the majority of the city council's position, versus a very reasonable support of Mayor McGinn's position, that's where I would go to look, is to the Crosscut website. And I think also what Berger said that isn't often pointed out is that Mayor McGinn isn't just lobbying, you know, he's not just lobbying dirt at the city council and at the tunnel project. He has an idea about some very viable alternatives to a tunnel. I mean, we've talked about it here on the show that, you know, if we didn't build the tunnel, a very viable alternative is a surface boulevard with improvements to transit and to I-5. And that alternative has not been studied. We know it would be a heck of a lot cheaper than a tunnel, and the problems, the potential for cost overruns would be a lot less than you would get with a tunnel built right directly along the waterfront. So tunnel opponents this week, too, and more news on the tunnel. Tunnel opponents this week filed an initiative on Thursday to try to get a public vote on the tunnel. That initiative was filed by a group called Seattle Citizens Against the Tunnel. They call themselves SCAT, kind of an unfortunate nickname. but they say they will need to get a little more than 20,000 signatures in the next 6 months, although their goal is to get that number in about 3 months so that they can qualify the initiative for the ballot in February of next year. They're not going to use paid signature gatherers, so they're relying on volunteers to come forward and help gather signatures by downloading the initiative from their website. That's Seattle Citizens Against the Tunnel. And if you do an internet search for that, you can probably find their website and find a copy of the initiative if you're interested in helping out. And then also this week in tunnel news, the Governor Gregoire was interviewed by the Seattle PI. And she warned that if Seattle rejects a tunnel, that if this initiative gets on the ballot and Seattle citizens vote against a tunnel, or if Seattle politicians, the mayor, wins a majority on the city council, I wouldn't hold my breath for that. But if Seattle rejects a tunnel, then the $2.6 billion in state money that's being set aside for an Alaskan Way viaduct replacement could just disappear. She basically said, you know, look, here's the reality in Olympia is that everybody wants a chunk of that highway money. And if Seattle decides they don't want to build the tunnel, then other groups are going to come in and want it. Other localities want money to replace infrastructure elsewhere, too. And that was kind of interesting. Gregoire, who claims that she wasn't responsible for the language that said that the city of Seattle would be responsible for cost overruns on the tunnel, here she's sitting there saying, well, you know, if you guys reject the tunnel, the money's gone. You know, it's awfully hard to believe her that she doesn't have some interest in forcing the tunnel through when she says stuff like that.
So money disappearing and being redistributed elsewhere.
Basically redistributed to other highway construction projects elsewhere in the state.
As opposed to the disappearing money like in the war in Iraq, where pallets full of money just disappeared.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little later today.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Uh-huh. All right. So anything else on local tunnel developments?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Moving on to national.
Yeah,
then.
The big news this week on the national scene was that a federal district court judge, Susan Bolton, issued a preliminary injunction against Arizona's immigration law that was due to go into effect on Thursday. She basically said that the state of Arizona could not put into effect the most controversial parts of the law. It was in response to the Obama administration lawsuit against the Arizona law saying that the state law contravenes the federal government's immigration policies. She largely sided with the Justice Department, and she said that, and furthermore, she brought into the argument something that the Obama administration had not sued Arizona for. She said that the law would place an unfair burden on legal immigrants and citizens of minority communities who have citizenship but could be suspected of being illegal immigrants. And it's because the way the law is written that police are required to do a check of people's documents regardless of who it is that they've arrested on what charge. And that if they can't immediately confirm that the person is a legal immigrant or a citizen, they can then detain that person until they're able to confirm that they are a legal resident or a citizen. So she basically said, you know, that places an undue burden on citizens of minority communities, and it places an unfair burden on legal immigrants who could be held and detained for, you know, not just days but weeks, if you consider how much of a backlog there is at the federal level in terms of immigration and verifying people's immigration status. So what I thought was interesting, you know, this was a preliminary injunction, which means it's not her final decision, but it really just gives you a look inside her mind. She's basically by issuing this preliminary injunction, she didn't just stop the major portions of the law from taking effect. She also basically let us see that she is sympathizing with the Obama administration's argument that the Arizona law contravenes the federal government's immigration policy. So that I found that to be an interesting ruling. And, of course, it led to a lot of protests in Arizona, both with supporters and opponents of the law. Supporters of the law were saying, oh, you know, here's the federal government falling down on the job. Here's a Clinton appointee who is siding with the liberals, you know, and it's going to bring chaos, et cetera, et cetera. And then there were folks who are against the law who are saying, you know, this is just a temporary ruling. And it didn't strike down all portions of the law. There were some parts of it that will go into effect, including the one that says that no municipality can declare itself a sanctuary city by saying that it will not enforce federal immigration law in the city. So that's a part of the Arizona law that will go into effect. So, you know, there were a lot of protests on both sides. What I found kind of interesting is that we here in Washington State don't always understand what the culture is in a state like Arizona or New Mexico or Texas, the border states, where a very large portion of the population, citizens, legal residents, what have you, are Hispanic. And many of them speak Spanish. Many of them don't speak Spanish, but have a slight accent to my ear or your ear. And, you know, they've been legal residents or they've been citizens of the United States for generations back. And those are the folks who are really going to be most impacted by this law. And, you know, you really have to know what the demographic is to really understand how dramatic it is for a law like this to be passed on the state level and for this court battle to be so meaningful. We don't really understand it here. We go, you know, what's the big deal? You know, but then if you knew, if you live in Arizona, you live in New Mexico and you know the demographics, then you really understand why it is a big deal.
All right. Moving on then to the big newsmaker for the week, which was WikiLeaks.
Yeah, WikiLeaks, who had posted, how long ago was it? Was it a few weeks back or a couple months back?
A couple months back.
A couple months back.
They posted the video?
Yeah, they posted the video of a helicopter, of a U.S. Military helicopter firing on people on the ground who they had thought were insurgents, but it was pretty clear that at least one of those people was a cameraman, a reporter. That video created an enormous controversy when it was posted on the WikiLeaks website, and since then there's been some fallout for the intelligence person. The military intelligence person who was suspected of leaking that videotape, Private First Class Bradley Manning. And just this past week, it was announced, WikiLeaks announced, well, we've got 90,000 plus documents from the U.S. military that we're posting that pertain to the war in Afghanistan. And evidently, several weeks ago, they had given access to these documents to three media outlets, The Guardian of London, Der Spiegel in Germany, and The New York Times. But they gave it to them on the condition that they wouldn't print anything about it before this past Sunday. And so, of course, on Sunday and Monday, the three media outlets, you know, posted their articles on it. What was very interesting is that the documents cover most of the timeline of the war. And then, of course, it immediately raised this question of, is it dangerous for WikiLeaks to have posted these documents on the Internet? And you didn't see very much reporting on it in the media, either from the New York Times or the other major media outlets. But the documents were marked secret, and that, and you know, if you read through the New York Times articles, they eventually admit, well, yeah, secret is a relatively low security classification, and so we didn't really have any problem with reading through them and writing these articles about their contents. And that WikiLeaks actually held back a large number of documents that they thought were too dangerous to post on the Internet. And what's very interesting, too, is I haven't seen any blow up over any of the details in any of the documents. Nobody's come forward and said, oh, you've leaked this name and now this person has died, or you've leaked information about this project or this military maneuver or whatever, and that's been a danger. Nobody's come forward with any details that are incriminating in terms of whether or not it's dangerous for these to have been posted on the Internet. The other question, of course, is there anything new here in amongst this vast number of documents and pages and pages and pages of information? And what's interesting is that there's not really much that's new. What's in there is the details of what we already know that make it clear that the bad things that we know about the war in Afghanistan are really much worse than we knew before. Some of the, you know, just a quick summary of some of the stuff that was in there. It basically confirms that the Afghan government, military, and police are corrupt and inept and hated by the Afghan people to the extent that the Afghan people are beginning to give their support to the Taliban instead as a preferred alternative. Also, the Taliban can, and they very easily do, acquire Afghan police and military weapons, uniforms, and vehicles from police and military personnel who are deserting their posts, basically because either they're not getting paid or they just can't stand working for such an inept organization. They decide, well, you know, I was promised X amount of money per month. I haven't gotten my salary for 3 months. I'm going over to the Taliban. You know, here's my gun. Here's my uniform. Here's a police vehicle that you can use in suicide bombings or whatever. That happens very, very often. Also, it confirms that Pakistani intelligence services are supporting the Taliban, even to the extent, and this is what really kind of shocked me, even to the extent of arming, training, directing the Taliban in their offensives, telling them which cities and which areas to attack when, and recruiting suicide bombers. I was pretty shocked by seeing some of that information. That's the extent to which the Pakistani military intelligence services are supporting the Taliban against the Afghan government and against the NATO troops. That's the piece that's the bit of information that's come out of all of these documents that I find probably the most shocking. But folks should remember too that the U.S. government is supporting the Pakistani government and military to the tune of about $1 billion a year. And in fact, Hillary Clinton was just over in Pakistan very recently, and she promised another $500 million to them in order to gain their support in the war in Afghanistan. Some other information that I found very interesting out of these documents is because the Afghan security forces are so terrible, many areas of Afghanistan are now being run by warlords and their militias. And I just want to remind folks that these are the same guys who brought civil war to Afghanistan in the late 80s and early 90s and really were responsible for the rise of the Taliban. The Taliban gained support and took to arms in order to put down these warlords in the first place and end the terrible atrocities of the Afghan civil war. And, of course, the fact that we're supporting these warlords now, and, you know, and that, of course, is the future of U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, is to arm these militias that are going to be controlled by warlords. Essentially, our policy going forward in Afghanistan in order to, quote unquote, win the war, because we can't win, you know, when we're funding both sides, the only way we can figure to quote unquote, win the war is to put the warlords back in power.
And we called those early on in the U.S. campaign the Northern Alliance, didn't we?
Well, no, the Northern Alliance kind of, well, yeah, no, you're right, that members of the Northern Alliance are some of the warlords who fought during the 1980s. You're right. You're absolutely right about that. And then, of course, the final thing I want to point out is that the documents confirm that U.S. and NATO airstrikes have been responsible for an ever-increasing number of civilian casualties, and that it's not just the U.S. that engages in airstrikes. It's other NATO members, including Britain and Germany, also put a lot of drones and a lot of planes up in the air and engage in strikes that often target civilians instead of the insurgents.
And I just heard recently the U.S. in both Afghanistan and Iraq has 3,000 robotic units, if you consider both the drones and the
surveillance
stuff on the mm-hmm. ground, as well as robots used for bomb detonation, things like that. And that currently the U.S. Air Force now is training more pilots for flying drones than they train for both fighters and bombers combined.
And that's interesting. So. Yeah. And the interesting thing about the drone pilots is that they don't have to be deployed to Afghanistan. They can sit in a room
here. Air-conditioned in Nevada.
In the U.S.
8-hour shift and then go home.
Yeah, and then go home, play with their kids,
sure.
You know, after they've bombed someone else's home, you know. It's so. Just incredible.
Anything else on Afghanistan?
No, let's talk about Iraq.
Okay.
Iraq had some interesting news this week. In Iraq, the Iraqi parliament canceled an already postponed session on Tuesday and said that they won't meet again until further notice. And that's very interesting because, you know, the elections were back in March. And here it is 4 months later. The Iraqi parliament is not even in session and Iraq doesn't have a new prime minister, doesn't have a governing coalition. The government is, in essence, in paralysis. And the reasons for that is Iraqiya, the alliance headed by Ayad Alawi, who won a bare majority in the election, didn't win enough seats to form a new government. He needs to have a coalition partner. Well, because he heads a secular coalition that also comprises Sunni politicians as well, none of the large Shiite groups will form a coalition with him. And the two Shiite groups, one is headed by Nuri al-Maliki, the guy who's currently serving as prime minister in the lame duck government, and Muqtada al-Sadr can't get together. They have conflicting ideas about how the country should be run. And of course, the al-Sadrists don't want to see Maliki appointed prime minister again. No one really wants to see Maliki continue as prime minister of the country, and he is unwilling to step down. So the government continues in paralysis within a month of when U.S. troops are supposed to be withdrawing from the country. In addition, the U.S. Special Investigator for Iraq Reconstruction issued a report this week. If you were reading the U.S. press, you wouldn't have read a single thing about it. I had to read about it in the British press. The report says that the U.S. Defense Department has completely lost track of $8.7 billion of money it withdrew from Iraq's Special Account for Reconstruction Projects. This is the account that is financed by Iraq's own oil money, money from the sale of Iraq's own oil. The total amount that has been withdrawn from the account by the U.S. Defense Department is $9.1 billion. So, of course, I got out my calculator and I did a little calculation. It turns out that the U.S. Defense Department has misappropriated and or completely lost 96% of the money that we have taken from Iraq in order to rebuild the country. And, of course, some of that money was partially tracked, but the U.S. military couldn't produce any records at all for $2.6 billion of it. That's almost 30% of that money was cash that just disappeared out of the account. Nobody has a receipt. Nobody has any idea who took it out or anything. There are no records for it at all. This money, I should point out, is on top of about $35 billion of U.S. taxpayer money that has been assigned for Iraq reconstruction. Most of that money, I'm assuming, must have also evaporated too, because there's really nothing to show for it. Iraqis still suffer without electricity, clean water, and sewage treatment, and even functioning medical facilities some 7 or 8 years after we invaded the country.
Pretty sure money doesn't evaporate.
It doesn't evaporate.
I don't remember learning that in science.
It goes somewhere, yeah. But clearly it's not going for what it was intended for.
All right. Anything else on Iraq?
No. Let's move on.
All right. Let's move on to a study coming out of Halifax.
Yeah. A couple of pieces of environmental news this week. First, the disturbing piece, a 3-year study by Canada's Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, has found a 40% decline in the world's phytoplankton population, most of it occurring since the 1950s. This corresponds with an increase in ocean temperatures during the same time. Scientists are calling this the biggest change to the global biosphere in modern history. And you might ask, why are they calling it that? Well, phytoplankton, it's that greenish stuff that floats around in the ocean. It's at the base of the marine food chain, and it essentially supports all of the ocean's fish stocks in the entire world. It also draws CO2 out of the atmosphere, so it's responsible for slowing down the effects of some of the greenhouse gases that we're pumping up into the air. But in addition, it also provides about half of the oxygen in the air we breathe. So not only is a 40% drop in the world's phytoplankton population a concern for the marine life, it's a concern for human life as well. If you want to continue to be able to breathe the air on planet Earth, we probably should address this problem. So that's the disturbing news this week. And, of course, again, you wouldn't have found this in the U.S. press. I had to go to the British press to find any information at all on this monumental study. Second, a little bit of uplifting news this week. The Plastiki sailed into Sydney Harbor. The what? The Plastiki. The Plastiki is a catamaran that was built from 12,500 plastic bottles. Its mast is made of a recycled aluminum irrigation pipe, and its sail is made from recycled plastic cloth. And it's all held together by an organic glue made from cashews and sugarcane waste. The Plastiki had a 6-person crew. They were inspired by Thor Heyerdahl's 1947 raft trip across the Pacific. Folks might remember the Contiki. They the current crew built the Plastiki out of plastic waste and named it the Plastiki in honor of Thor Heyerdahl. And one of the crew members is Heyerdahl's grandson, Olaf. On their trip across the Pacific, they referred to Heyerdahl's journals, and they made observations of the Pacific. What they found is that when Heyerdahl crossed the Pacific in the 1940s, he couldn't go into the water because there were sharks everywhere. And during the trip, they were able to eat fish the whole time. In fact, their diet consisted largely of tuna, as well as other types of fish. The Plastiki's crew found that they could swim freely. They did not see a single shark on their entire trip. They did, however, any time they dove below the surface of the water, they encountered lots of plastic waste. And while they did fish during the entire trip, they only caught fish twice, and they ate tuna only once on their entire journey. The Plastiki crew are now spending a lot of time trying to educate people about plastic waste in the ocean. Plastic waste makes up 60% to 80% of all marine waste. Approximately 15 billion pounds of plastic are produced in the U.S. every year, and only 1 billion pounds is recycled. And according to the crew members, quote, waste is fundamentally inefficient design. That I believe that to be very true. And if you want to read more about the Plastiki, you can do an internet search for them. It's Plastiki, like the Contiki.
And that's your uplifting story.
Yeah, sorry.
All right. Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
People can find Eat the State at www.eatthestate.org online. We can some of our print issues will be coming out about the election. We're going to be doing the election endorsements for the primary next week. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or you want to get involved and volunteer, you can email us at editorial@eatthestate.org.